see, February 23rd, 2005. It's a beautiful day outside. I got a phone call from my daughter who lives in Phoenix, Arizona, and it's raining there, and it's sunshiny here, and it's 68 degrees in Newport, according to the news. So it's awesome. Well, you know, healthcare costs, we are in a healthcare cost crisis, and this is part of our informational hearings that we're hearing. And I would like to call Ruth Rogers Bowman, a consultant from Leverage Decisions, who's going to talk on healthcare financing issues for hospitals.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, Senators. Well, for most people, looking at a hospital bill or looking at the statement they get from their insurance company can be quite confusing for hospitals.
You'll have to move it. Yeah. People in the back can't hear. And please identify yourself.
My name's Ruth Rogers Bauman. I'm a healthcare consultant with Leverage Decisions. And so today I'd like to talk to you about healthcare financing issues for hospital care. For the average consumer, a hospital bill is quite intimidating with its detailed charges, and the statement from the insurance company is also confusing in trying to relate those payments to the charges. So today I'd like to try to explain what, how those charges are arrived at, how carriers and other payers come up with what they pay, and then how those things get reflected in financial statements for hospitals. Before I do that, I'd like to talk a little bit about what hospital services are so we're on the same page. There are two major categories, inpatient and outpatient services. Inpatient services are when the patient is admitted, and outpatient services are services that are rendered where the patient can come in and go home. On the inpatient side, they can be as complicated as an organ transplant or as simple as an uncomplicated delivery. On the outpatient side, there's quite a variability of services. They may be an outpatient surgery, or they may be as simple as a blood test. So we have a continuum of services from the very complicated to the fairly simple. And we would generally expect then that costs would probably follow that continuum, but they don't. Certainly, transplants are quite expensive, but we also find that in some cases, some outpatient services are more expensive than inpatient services. Some outpatient surgery bills are higher than inpatient bills. In fact, a payer may find themselves in a situation where an outpatient surgery may cost more when it's done in the outpatient setting than the very same service might be in an inpatient setting. So we have some peculiar things that happen in pricing that makes it very confusing to try to follow. So what I'd like to do is then talk about how do hospitals come up with their charge pattern. I think if you'll refer to this document that you have. Do we have it? So let's clarify some terms that can be kind of confusing. We have charges. Charges are the amount, the dollar amount that's put on a service that you can think of as the full retail price. So it's the full price. If we were talking about a hotel bill, it would be the rack rate. If we were talking about a car, it would be the manufacturer's suggested retail price. So the charge amount is the full fully loaded price that a hospital establishes. The allowed amount is the amount that a hospital has agreed to accept from a payer. It might be a government payer, it might be a private insurance company, it might be an individual. But the allowed amount then is something usually less than that full charge amount. And the cost then is the actual cost of services. So first let's talk about how a hospital arrives at its charges. The first step in determining is to determine how much revenue is needed. So this is a pretty simple equation. It's pretty similar to any other business. The total required revenue would be the total cost plus the profit that the organization wants to make. But the second thing that the hospital has to do is it has to account for discounts, has to account for charity care and bad debt. So the total charge then has to cover all of the required premium or revenue, plus discounts, plus the charity care, plus bad debt. So it includes all the costs, the profit markup, and then an allowance to consider the fact that they'll get a discount from a number of payers. So if we look at that little exhibit at the bottom, we see that the revenue has to support all of those items we just talked about. The revenue, then, that they receive from payers, which is listed at the bottom, shows that from different kinds of payers, they can expect to get more or less money. Medicaid probably pays the least proportion of charges. So the allowed amount for a Medicaid program is generally in the 50 to 55% range for a hospital. For Medicare, it's a little bit higher, somewhere around 55 to 60%. For private insurers, it might be anywhere from 70 to 95%. And for those who self-pay, they pay the full retail price, or 100%. Those ratios between the charge amount and the cost are what people call the ratio of cost to charges. So it's the relationship between the full retail price and the charge to the payer. Another way to think of it, it's the markup that is on the hospital services. So that's how they arrive at their total cost, their total charges. But how do they actually get the cost then for each individual service? Well, again, they follow a pattern pretty similar to most businesses when they look at the individual services that they render. So they will take their total cost that they can directly allocate to a particular service, their direct cost. Let's use an example of a lab test. They'll look at the labor costs associated with that test, the supplies, the equipment they need, all of those direct costs, and that gets allocated to the service. And they know that they need to have a price then that covers those costs. But then it gets a little stickier when they try to allocate other costs that they bear. You know, you're all familiar enough with budgets to know about indirect cost. So the hospital then has to take all of their indirect costs, which might be the cost of the building, utilities, management, accounting, legal services, and try to attribute some portion of that to that individual service. Once they've done that, now they've got their total cost, both direct and indirect, for it. Now, when we talk about pricing and how they get paid for that, we'll see that that influences how they go about attributing or allocating those costs to individual services. From that, they come up with a price for the service, or cost for the service, I should say, and that cost is what goes into the total charge master. They apply, of course, their loads for bad debt, charity, and for profit. So if you look at the graph on the second page, you'll see really just a picture of what all that means. If we look at the different payers, the green area represents the cost of the services provided to each of those categories of payers. The profit margin then is added on top of that. This figure is not meant to be representative in terms of relativity. As long as the price that they receive from an individual payer is above that green area, then they've recovered their costs. As it moves up into the profit area, then they actually also earn a profit on that service. So when we talk about the ratio of cost to charges, a hospital isn't losing money until they eat down into the cost area. So many times what we're talking about is a reduction of profit on an individual service or a payer group, and it's not until we actually eat into the actual cost that we have an issue with losses. However, we still have to consider the fact that there's some subjectivity in how those indirect costs are allocated. So there can be some gray areas and some disagreements about what the actual cost of the service is and whether full costs were captured or not from a payer.
Question?
Yes.
Tell me how building costs factor in and capital investments. A lot of hospitals expanding their birthing centers, making them real nice, fancy rooms, and technology, imaging services, and every hospital has to have all of the up-to-date imaging services. How do those things factor in to
the cost?
The cost.
All of those costs have to be factored into the cost of the individual services. So, for example, if they buy, you know, a new MRI machine that's the latest in technology for that, that's going to have a higher cost, and that's going to have to get factored into the cost of MRIs. Same would be true for a birthing center. Now, the hospital has some choices to make where they might want to cross-subsidize some of those costs. So they may choose to put all their building costs together and allocate them across all services. That commonly happens, as it does with most businesses. Hospitals are kind of unique in their accounting of capital expenditures, though. For a private business, a capital expenditure like that is depreciated over time, and that depreciated cost is reflected in their financial statement. Hospitals live with one foot in the private world and one foot in the public world. So they borrow some of the practices from public accounting when it comes to capital expenditures. So in some cases, rather than depreciating that over time, you know, 5 or 10 years, they may realize that entire expense in the year in which it's purchased. That's often reflected in the financial statement as a full cost. It comes under a category called funded depreciation, which is quite unique to hospitals. We'll talk a little bit about that when we talk about financial statements. But those costs all get built into those services.
Does Medicare or Medicaid reimburse? Are there reimbursements for capital expenditure type issues? Or is it strictly patient? Is Medicare and Medicaid strictly a patient driven subsidy?
Both Medicaid and Medicare, depends on how they go about reimbursing, but they have what they call permissible costs or allowed costs for the hospital. Hospitals have to submit a cost report, which they then verify that only those costs which are allowed are captured there. Some capital expenditures are allowed in those costs. Luxury items are not, lobbying's not, and some now medical education is excluded.
What kind of capital expenditures are allowed? Give an example.
Equipment costs are allowed as part of that.
So the imaging services and those types are part
right,
of it.
Right. And I can get you some more information on what is and isn't allowed.
Thank you.
yes,
Senator Morrison.
Now, are you somewhere differentiating between the nonprofits and the for-profits?
Both for-profit and non-for-profit hospitals use fairly similar techniques in reporting their costs and allocating their costs. The main difference is what they do with the profit or what's left over at the end of that and who they need to account to. For-profit organizations, of course, have stockholders that they have to account to, but the basic accounting is the same for both organizations.
Okay.
Now, probably where you'd find some differences is in the depreciation of equipment. A for-profit hospital will generally depreciate it as a business would so that they meet all the GAAP requirements, whereas a non-profit hospital probably would not or may choose something in between. They use more of a blended model.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So let's turn our attention then to how payers then come about deciding how to go about pricing their services. What's the allowed amount? How do they come up with that? Prior to the middle 80s, most hospital services were reimbursed on a cost basis. Medicare reimbursed on a cost basis. They went through their allowable expenses. They might have excluded certain things, but basically hospitals then got the full amount of those cost services. Most private insurers at that time did exactly the same thing. The Blue Cross Association was formed around the idea of coming up with hospital contracts and doing pretty much that, paying full cost for those. In the middle 1980s, a prospective payment system was developed called DRGs, which for the inpatient side said, let's put some rules and some boundaries around what we pay for. Cost pricing and allowing the full amount doesn't put any control on cost going forward, and Medicare wanted some kind of controls to be able to predict what their costs would be from year to year. So the DRG system was developed. What DRGs are, diagnostic related groups, and it's simply a classification of a type of admission into the hospital. So it looks at, you know, what's the diagnosis of the patient, do they have any other comorbidities or any other diagnoses when they're admitted, and how old are they? There's 400 and some of those classifications, and basically you can consider each of those a bag of services or a set number of services. Hospitals are then paid for that DRG amount. They get a specific amount regardless of what the charges are associated with it. So if a patient stays longer, the hospital still only gets the DRG amount. If they are released sooner, the hospital's cost might be less. They still get the full DRG amount. same with any other costs associated with it. So the hospital takes some risk that they can provide the service within that allowed amount and still make money off of it.
Is that DRG, when we're talking about being reimbursed from Medicare or Medicaid, now Medicaid, it would be...
Medicaid's still using primarily cost-based reimbursement on the fee-for-service side, but for many of the contractors for Medicaid, they're using a DRG scheme. So that's their choice to do that. The DRG scheme was adopted by most commercial carriers shortly after Medicaid developed it, and now it's a fairly common approach. It also has within it a kind of a safeguard in case a patient gets very ill and their costs become quite high. An additional payment, called an outlier payment, can be made in the case of those uncommon situations where costs are quite high. And so the hospital's projected that if somebody gets very ill, has many problems, then they get an additional payment amount. Hospitals for Medicare, there are what are called DRG hospitals, and those hospitals receive payment under the DRG scheme. Not all services fall under that because there are still some services, for example, burns and a lot of trauma cases that fall outside of that scheme. They're not very predictable. It's hard to tell what they might cost on average, and so they're not subject to DRG payments. For type A and B hospitals, they don't receive DRG payments, and they're still on a cost-based reimbursement scheme. That's also true pretty much in the commercial world, particularly in Oregon, that most commercial carriers follow the same pattern that Medicare does in their reimbursement in terms of who gets paid DRG and who doesn't.
Now, when you say cost basis, is that usually higher or lower, or could it depend?
It could depend. It could be either way. But what it, when they're being paid on a cost basis, the hospital no longer has a risk about whether the fixed payment is going to be higher or lower than their cost. So it's simply a matter of passing through those costs, just like you would on any other government contract.
And say again who usually uses cost basis versus DRGs?
The Part A and B hospitals, the smaller hospitals do.
Use the
cost basis.
Cost basis.
And then even in larger hospitals, some types of services are exempt from DRG and are paid on a cost basis. Now, for private payers, for commercial carriers, they have, for the most part, adopted the Medicare approach. However, hospitals don't have to follow that approach with private carriers. They can negotiate different payments. They can negotiate not to use DRGs and to be on a cost basis. In Oregon, in the last few years, there has been kind of a retreat from using the prospective payment system to more cost-based reimbursement. So we've seen, you know, fewer hospitals being paid on DRGs, and within hospitals, less payments controlled under the DRG methodology. Now, on the outpatient side, we have kind of a similar approach, although it's not as advanced. Outpatient services are pretty much paid on a cost basis today, except for outpatient surgery. Medicare has developed a prospective payment for outpatient services, but they haven't fully implemented it. And most commercial carriers have not implemented it. So, for the most part, on the outpatient side, that's being paid on a cost basis.
So you were saying earlier that many outpatient surgeries are more expensive than in hospital.
Right. So, for example, if a given service, let's say it's a particular surgery, if the payer has a contract for a DRG payment in the hospital and has a cost-based payment on the outpatient side, it's quite possible that it could cost more if it's done as an outpatient than it could as an inpatient.
And do you have data that supports that or shows that?
I have, in my previous career, I have seen lots of data that supports
okay.
that. So. And it depends. Sometimes it's a rare circumstance. Sometimes it's fairly common. So those are things that people look for when they are examining reimbursement issues. So carriers also, when they apply these techniques, typically are trying to target a certain discount from the total charge amount. So they are if they're using a prospective payment amount like a DRG or on the outpatient side, if they're using one of the mechanisms on the outpatient side, they will want the amount that they pay per service in total to reach some sort of a discounted amount. And that might be somewhere between as low as 70% and as high as maybe even 95%. So they're getting a discount of somewhere between 5 and 30%. Even on a cost basis, they will usually have what's called a discount to charges arrangement. They'll allow the cost, but then pay a certain percentage or allow a certain percentage of that cost. So they may allow 90%, 80%, and then base their benefit payment off of that allowed amount. So that's how carriers go about determining how much they allow and what they agree with the hospitals.
On the self-pay, or are you going to get to talking about self-pay later?
No, we're going to ask you.
Yeah. For those who are self-pay, and I know, is there a correlation with charity care? For those who self-pay, do they look at a sliding fee scale for the amount of income that they have?
Right. They typically will look at their ability to pay and reduce the payment on that basis. If you have an ability to pay, and as you know probably from previous information you've received, there are a significant number of people who are uninsured who have higher incomes. They're going to pay the full amount. As that amount decreases, the hospitals can negotiate and set up an arrangement with individuals on their ability to pay. But it's purely up to the hospital's policies about how to do that.
And is that public knowledge or not?
It's generally not public knowledge. I mean, you can back into it by looking at what's the write-off that they received for charity. But that's usually a fairly big number, and it can be difficult to find out what that is. So it's usually a case-by-case basis that they do it on. So you'd have to dig into the actual hospital records to find it.
Thank you.
Now, so, we've talked about charges and allowed amounts that are negotiated. It's sometimes hard to keep in mind then how does anybody ever break even if they only get 50 or 60 or 70% of the total charges. Well, if we go back to our little green bars here, again, the hospital will break even in total as long as the allowed amounts exceed those green bars. They don't suffer a loss until revenue drops so low that they actually fall into their true cost and begin to get into that. So it's very similar to what most industries do in segmenting the market. You know, if you fly on a plane, you know that almost every passenger on that plane is paying a different rate. Some are paying quite a lot if they had circumstances that they had to be on a certain flight at a certain time. A business passenger might pay $2,000 or $3,000. Somebody who's using frequent flyer miles might be there paying nothing. So in that same way, there's a wide variety of payments that are being made. That doesn't mean there's a loss on any one of those individuals. It's simply a scheme of segmenting the market and being able to charge what you can to individuals. Now, in...
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
I know you said that your green chart wasn't accurate proportionally.
Right.
But are you maintaining at this point that hospitals realize a profit from Medicare and Medicaid?
No, not necessarily.
Okay, well, the box is there, and I just
don't
want the committee to think that somehow there's profit in all segments here. So.
No, there's not profits in all segments, okay. Although there's probably profits for the larger hospitals in all three segments, and for some hospitals there's no profit in any of the segments. So.
There's profits for the large hospitals in all three segments?
In some cases in Medicare, they'll make a profit on Medicare.
Maybe Medicaid, I'm not sure how, but if there is a way, I'd like to know.
Well, I can tell you in the 1980s through the mid-90s, hospitals, when they went under the DRG payment scheme, made money in DRGs. They were able to keep costs down. They were almost flat for a 10-year period, and they didn't go out of business. And Medicaid makes up probably 40 to 50% of their business. So it was a matter of being able to control their costs beneath what Medicare would pay. So it is possible to do that. And I think if you look at some of the American Hospital Association data, they'll show that not all hospitals lose money on Medicare patients.
Okay, Madam Chair, but this isn't 95 anymore. It's 2005, so we're in a different world. So
true. So At any rate, though, there are different profit margins on different segments of the population. So whether a hospital can break even depends on whether they can accumulate enough profit from the various segments that they work with. Now, in their financial statements, as I mentioned before, there are a couple peculiarities about hospital reporting that's important to note when you're looking at a financial statement. One is that there's a charity care write-off, which is different from most businesses. They don't usually include charity care, obviously. You'll see that as a reduction to revenue. There also, though, is a revenue for donations that can be shown in the financial statement, so they also have an amount there. And then the other portion of that is the capital expenditures that we talked about earlier, that capital expenditures can be expensed more quickly than you would find in another business, and that's usually under some category called funded depreciation or pre-funded depreciation in their balance sheets.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Chris.
Do hospitals have the ability to, I mean, could they write off all capital in that way, or are there proportional things where they can, or categorical things where they can write off some and not others?
I mean, I'm not aware of any rules surrounding that, but I'm not an accountant. Okay. So it's possible that there are some.
Okay, I guess I would be curious as to, I mean, one would assume there have got to be some rules around that, just because there are rules around that sort of thing.
Around everything, right.
Right.
And do hospitals have the same criteria for a reporting charity care? Do they include the same costs?
They report their charity care by starting at the full charge amount, and then reporting any reduction down to the amount they've agreed to accept.
Okay. So, and all hospitals do that?
Yes. I don't know of any that don't do it that way. Physicians generally do that also. So it's the amount from the amount that they otherwise would be their full bore rate down to what's allowed.
Now, Madam Chair, that confused me just a little bit. You know, they have full charges. They get X for Medicare, X for Medicaid. They get X for the agreements they have with private insurers. Mm-hmm. They get X for the private pay based on what they negotiate with those individuals. Mm-hmm. The charity care they're getting nothing for. So where are they negotiating down to?
But in some cases, it may be down to zero. In other cases, some of the self-pay people, part of their...
That's part of it. So self-pay, what they don't collect in self-pay, is that considered part of charity care?
Right.
Okay.
Right. And then you have, you know, bad debt that they are not able to collect, just like any other business
right.
has. So may I answer any other questions? Thank you.
You're done. That was very informative. Okay, now we'll be going into Oregon's acute care hospitals capacity, utilization, and financial trends. And we'll call Dr. Bruce Goldberg from the Oregon Health Policy and Research Commission. Task Force?
Office.
And Tina Edlund from the Oregon Health Policy and Research Office.
All right, good afternoon. You want to introduce yourself?
Sure. For the record, Bruce Goldberg, Office of Health Policy and Research. And my role here today is that Tina requested that if her heart should stop beating, that she wanted to be certain there was a doctor next to her to restart it. She's often a little intimidated, so I'm here to both restart her heart as well as to make certain that everybody's nice to her.
Where's the closest external defibrillator?
We'll just plug in over here.
Chairman, with that introduction, thank you, Bruce. Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tina Edlund, and I'm the manager, the research and data manager with the Office for Health Policy and Research. I'm here today to basically present a summary of our report that I think you all have a copy in front of you, and we've had copies delivered to your offices as well, that was completed in December of 2004. So And this report covers the capacity utilization and financial trends of acute care community hospitals in the state of Oregon from 1995 to 2003. The report is actually a compilation of data that we're statutorily required to collect. It's a combination for utilization data. It's from the hospital discharge database. For financial data, we actually obtain the audited financial records of every hospital in the state. Under statute, they're required to submit those to our office within 120 days of the end of their fiscal year. So those are the sources for the data. It's probably worth noting a little bit about the process for putting this report together. We, in October of 2004, we actually sent the individual data sheets. You'll see at the back of the hospital report, there's actually individual level data on every hospital in the state. We sent that out to the hospitals for their review. At the beginning of December, we actually cut off that review period. We heard back from 32 hospitals. In 17 cases, we made changes in the report based on information that they gave and clarifications of their data. If we go to the first slide, there are currently 59. Wait, did I skip one? Oh, I probably should clarify that acute care hospitals, this doesn't include any of the specialty hospitals in the state, the psychiatric hospitals, or long-term care facilities. There are currently 59 acute care hospitals in the state, not including the VA. It also doesn't include the federal facilities. 57 of them are not-for-profit, 2 are for-profit. This compares to nationally about 16% of all hospitals are for-profit hospitals. So I think that's 3% here. The 2 for-profit hospitals are Willamette Valley Medical Center in McMinnville and the new Physicians Hospital, which recently purchased the Woodland Park Hospital in East Portland. For the purposes of this report, and I'm so glad that Ms. Bauman came before me, she could explain much of this. For the purposes of this report, we divided the hospitals into the DRG hospitals, which are by and large they're the larger urban hospitals generally. There are a few exceptions to that, and the Type A and Type B hospitals. Just for definitions, since 1984, under Medicare law, hospitals have received a fixed payment for each patient based on the diagnostic-related group that patient falls into. So if you go in for a normal childbirth without complications, there's a set rate that you get paid for that childbirth as the hospital. And again, as I said, those hospitals are primarily the larger urban hospitals. A, B, and C hospitals are really a reflection of the sense of the Oregon legislature in 1987. They recognized that the rural hospitals in the state had particular vulnerabilities. So they granted authority to the Office of Rural Health to categorize rural hospitals into 3 classifications. Type A, which are really the most remote hospitals, they have to be less than 50 beds and more than 30 miles from the nearest facility. Nearest acute inpatient facility. Type B is they're rural. They can be within 30 miles of another facility, but they're less than 50 beds. And then Type C are considered rural hospitals, but they're larger and they're usually paid on a DRG basis. Type A and B hospitals, that's purely an Oregon designation. It's for Oregon's Medicaid program. You don't see it in other states. I mean, they may have their own form of it, but this is unique to Oregon, and they're reimbursed at 100% of reasonable costs by Medicaid, and that comes from, as was explained earlier, that comes from the cost reports that they submit. In addition, another reimbursement piece is critical access hospitals. In 1997, Congress did basically what the Oregon legislature had done before and established a hospital payment system called critical access hospitals, again aimed at improving the financial stability of rural hospitals across the country. Critical access hospitals receive enhanced Medicare reimbursement. They actually receive 101% of reasonable costs. All but 2 of Oregon's Type A rural hospitals are critical access hospitals, and 10 of the 20 Type Bs, a little kind of less remote hospitals, are critical access hospitals. So For a good part of our rural hospitals, they are getting paid at 100% of cost by both Medicaid and Medicare.
Now say that again. Most type A and B hospitals.
Almost all the type A's are also critical access hospitals, so they get they receive 100% of reasonable costs from Medicaid and 101% of reasonable costs from Medicare.
Okay.
I guess the reason.
Senator George.
That reasonable cost, is there any relationship between their actual cost? Is that reasonable cost what their actual costs are, or?
Chair Monis Anderson, Senator George, my understanding is that it's just based on their cost reports, that some hospitals have actually done extensive cost studies within their hospital. It's a little bit more difficult for the small rural hospitals to do that.
But these are cost reports that are Medicare cost reports that are submitted to the federal government.
On an individual hospital?
On an individual hospital basis, but there are standards around how each of those things are accounted for.
So to get to the reason why we pay this much attention to hospitals and do all this work is because they're such an important part of the healthcare system. They account for more than one third of national healthcare expenditures. Hospital expenditures do. In Oregon, that number, the most recent number we have for hospital expenditures overall, is from 1998, and it shows that we're about that one third mark here as well. More recent numbers from 2002-2003 of the OMAP, looking at the OMAP data and Medicaid data in our state, show that hospital costs account for about 30% of the overall Medicaid budget here as well. So it's pretty much the same across the state and the country.
And that has been pretty consistent?
Yeah.
For years?
In the time period I've focused on, which really is the 95 forward time period. So I can't talk about time period before that. The first section of this report that, as we move into capacity, it's looking at the number of beds in the state, because obviously that's the key to capacity, is the number of beds. The number of licensed beds per 1,000 population, rather than just looking at the raw, there's about a little over 6,700 licensed beds in the state. But to make that make more sense, we can look at it per 1,000 population. In 2003, Oregon had 1.9 licensed hospital beds per 1,000 population, compared to other states in the Pacific region, which is Alaska, Hawaii, Washington, Oregon, and California, where there were 2.1 beds and then 2.8 beds nationally. Now, to look at that, that doesn't really tell us too much. It's just a number until we start to look at occupancy, which tells us how often those beds are occupied, are full. As a result of, during the time period again of this report, which was 1995 to 2003, as a result of hospital closures or consolidations, the capacity decreased by 6% in the state. The number of staffed beds, and I should explain, there's a difference. A hospital usually you have staffed beds and you have licensed beds, and there are usually more licensed beds, not always, but usually more licensed beds than staffed. And staffed means that you have the staff to actually take care of a patient who might occupy that bed. And these numbers, these occupancy trends are looking at staffed beds. They're also looking at an average. It's really important to note that, because on any given day in a hospital, a particular unit could be full. So this is looking at just average occupancy over the course of a year. Statewide, 64.4% of they had an occupancy rate of 64.4%. Now I'm going to get my glasses out. 69.6% in the DRG hospitals, and the type A and the type B hospitals, again, the smaller, more rural hospitals with less population to occupy the beds, 37.1% in the type A and 39.5% in type B. As you can see, though, I think it's important to note that even with a decrease in the number of beds during this time period, you actually saw an overall increase in occupancy. It went from 48% to 64% during this time period, which, again, it
can be seen as an efficiency measure.
I thought with the advent of HMOs that decreased. I thought hospitals were becoming more efficient and not keeping people as long.
Right,
I know that
length of stay actually declined.
Length of stay declined. Because I know people were being sent. Okay.
Right. Well, actually, in Oregon, it stayed even. But
and Chair Mona Sanderson, I think the other point is that this report is 95 to 2003, and 95, 96, 97 was probably the peak of managed care in this state, and the latter part of the 90s and certainly the beginning of 2000, we've seen less.
Okay, in workforce, there's actually quite a lot of detail in the report itself. If you wanted to look by category, what happened over this period of time to each category, occupational category within the hospital, at least within the categories that we look at. Workforce actually, again, adjusting for admissions, increased from 1995 to 2003 of 5.7 per 100 admissions to 6.3. Overall, there was a 35% increase in the workforce, but again, admissions grew some too. The nurse FTE or full-time equivalency grew by 20% during this time period. The most significant increases were among the aides and orderlies and technicians, perhaps reflecting a shift to more outpatient care.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Do you have that broken down geographically at all?
We can't. I don't have it broken down in this report, but I can't.
As we look at workforce needs, that's going to be kind of a critical factor.
It is broken out by the A, B, and DRG hospitals, so you can have a gross cut at urban, rural, but nothing more than that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. The next slide shows utilization of hospital services in the state and the top 10 DRGs in 2003. And this just simply tells you what people in Oregon are using hospitals for. And it's like you would expect to see all over the country. It's for childbirth and psychoses and hip replacements. the next slide shows admissions per 1,000. Again, from 1995 to 2003, this basically tells us that in a real sense, when you control for population, there was a...
Can we go back to that slide?
Yeah.
It's quite a bit of it is deliveries. And it seems that a whole lot has to do with females.
And I think I heard this number before. Women use the hospital more than men, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. And broken it down to age, of course, childbirth age. But then after you get to 65, it's still more women using hospitals than men.
I don't know the answer to that.
I'm not trying to be sexist here.
Women live longer, so
you go ahead. Just go ahead and see.
I should also point out that on that the utilization of hospital services, those are numbers rather than dollars. So it's numbers.
While we're still there, normal newborn, that's well baby and stuff like that. So things that are happening in hospitals that could be happening other places, okay.
Yes, Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Cruz, yes, that's right.
That's interesting.
Really?
That's number one.
Well, it's the things that happen in the hospital for the baby.
For the baby,
yeah.
Babies in.
So
right, not
well baby checks, it's the initial.
It's the initial.
Yeah.
Okay. No, it's not what happens at the doctor's office later.
Right. And it's number one because you'll have cesarean sections, vaginal deliveries. They may be complicated deliveries, but a normal newborn. This is the day or two of life, the first day or two of life that's spent in the hospital.
Okay, thank you.
Then if we, admissions per 1,000has increased by 6%. Then average length of stay. Average length of stay in the state has actually stayed fairly even. It's just moved slightly up from 3.8 days to 3.9. As you can see, we're very low in the length of stay here. It's in the Pacific region, it's 4.8. And in the U.S., it's 5.1.
This length of stay, however, as you also will note here, that we may have a short length of stay, but we have high expenses per inpatient day. According to the Kaiser Family Foundation, using American Hospital Association data, we are second highest in the nation for costs per inpatient day.
Is the Health Safety Commission that we formed last session looking at relapses, is that part of their charge? Is either of you sit on that?
No, readmission rates, and I don't know.
Okay.
Madam Chair, while we're there, I mean, the length of stay, number one, you have senior populations, and they, the intensive services are in the hospital, then they transfer to a nursing home or other facilities. So do, I mean, I guess I'm looking at the continuum of care, things that in Oregon happen outside of the hospital that would happen still in the hospital in other states. So do we have any data on the continuum?
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Cruz, we don't have specific data in our office on that continuum. However, I think that's exactly right from the reading and background work I've done. It's that we do. There's less end of life kinds of activities happening in the hospital. There's, as you said, more movement into nursing facilities.
Yeah, and I guess, Madam Chair, that, you know, that relates not only to a shorter stay, which isn't necessarily less care, but it also factors into a higher expense because it's a higher level of acuity when they're in there. So
that's right, and that is an important point, because many of them go into a nursing home and then they get intensive physical therapy and those types of things that are needed, and then sent home after that.
Okay. Okay, inpatient days per 1,000 population. Again, Oregon is very low. There's been an increase from 1995 to 2003, from 365 inpatient days per 1,000 population to 412, I'll round up. In the Pacific region, that's about 507 days, inpatient days, and across the U.S., it's 676. Now, for the last but not least part of the report, the measuring financial health. As I said, we're statutorily required to collect the audited financial data from each of the hospitals in the state. What we look at when we look at the financials is we really focus on two measures. One is their operating margin, which is really just the money that's left over after they pay for, it's the expenses from the revenues from direct patient care, so it's their operating margin. It measures how profitable they are. It's equivalent to profit, although these are not-for-profit facilities, so it's just the excess when all is said and done. Total margin is a slightly different animal.
Profit. A lot of hospitals, I would think, or maybe not, with that profit, invest. Are they investing that money into stocks or bonds? Are there any regulations?
Chair Mona Sanderson, I'm not familiar with the specific regulations around not-for-profit hospitals, what they can and can't do with that money. I know that they would use it for capital expenditures.
They would or would not.
They would use it for building new facilities, for upgrading equipment, for all the things you would do as you're taking care of your business.
The same as a for-profit would.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think the difference is that excess at the end of whatever period isn't paid out to shareholders.
Mm-hmm. Another question that I have, a lot of them are on foundations. I'm actually on a foundation board for one of the hospitals in my area, the only hospital in my district. But and we raise a lot of money for the hospitals, and we invest a lot of money and put that back in. Is any of that taken into account?
Chair Mona Sanderson, that is taken into account in the total margin. Yeah. The operating margin only accounts for, as I said, the direct patient care activities. The total margin actually includes foundation money. It includes any non-patient care activities, the gift shop. It also, in some cases, if you have a health district or a taxing district that you exist in, that's there to support the hospital, it would include those tax appropriations as well. So overall, for the state, total operating revenue, and again, this is just the revenue from their direct patient care activities, in 2003 was $5.1 billion. That's up 54% from 1995. At the same time, their total operating expenses were $4.9 billion, up 54.5% from 1995. So their net operating income across the state is $233 million in 2003.
Now, this is for all hospitals in the state.
All hospitals in the state.
And we know that some have a profit, but others...
And that's where we're going.
And actually, in the report... In the bound report that you have in front of you, actually, you can look at all of the statistics for every individual hospital. Mm-hmm. We'll just present to you now a breakout of urban versus rural.
Mm-hmm. If we look at the margins for the state, looking at the statewide numbers, the operating and total margins, it's, as you can see, I mean, the literature basically says that an operating margin of 3 to 5% is a sign of financial health. And it looks like the hospitals are doing generally well in the state. Their operating margins are sometimes below that, but they hover right around that. But it's really combining all the hospitals together masks, I think, some really important financial, some of the financial picture in the state. If we look at on the next slide on page 18.
Still on page 17. Mm-hmm. So in the 90s when we were doing well, you'd think that in the good times people wouldn't get as sick, but I guess we get sick no matter what. I'm just surprised that the profits were over five, and then it starts, you know, leveling out, I guess you would call. Is that significant or not? No?
I think that's, you know, significance is in the eye of the beholder.
Okay. All right.
Well, Madam Chair, also the ratio of expenses to profits was tightening by a small percent, but it's kind of within the realm of the percentage change here too. So
if we look, the next slide shows what the total and operating margins were during this period of time for just the DRG hospitals. And as you can see, that's what's really driving that statewide picture is those larger DRG hospitals, and they look pretty good during this time period. Their operating margins are up where we would expect them to be, and their total margins are in an acceptable, well, again, that's in the eye of the beholder. They're in a range anyway.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
That 5.2, you said when you're talking total margin, that's including their foundations and everything, which would have a large impact because, trust me, the A's don't have foundations.
No.
And let's go back to when you say usually it's good if a business has a 3 to 5% profit. I mean, are you talking business in general and you're...
That was specific to hospitals.
Just that's mm-hmm. what I thought.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'd also like to... I think it's important to, again, looking at the individual hospital data in this report, is that while overall DRG hospitals look good, again, that figure does mask the fact that some DRG hospitals are doing better than others. And there's not time or enough paper to show all of that here today, but it is in the report. You can look at the individual hospitals. The next slide shows the type A hospitals, and these are the smallest, most remote hospitals. And as you can see, the operating margin is negative in 7 out of 9 years. These are the hospitals that really can't make enough from direct patient care to make their operating expenses. In many cases, what local communities have done was come together and form health districts. There are 13 health districts in the state that support hospital operations, and sometimes it's operations, sometimes it's capital expenditures. They assist hospitals in a variety of ways. And that in some cases, again, not in every case, but in some cases is the key to the survival for these hospitals.
So how are they subsidized, do you say?
Well, they form health districts that can actually levy taxes. So they can levy, in some cases, the health districts only levy taxes for capital building projects. In other cases, this actually provides some ongoing operating revenue.
So are you saying all of our type A?
No, not at all. There are 13 health districts. I'm saying some of them have formed together as a community to do that.
So there are 13 health districts, and how many type A hospitals in those 13 districts?
I don't have that with me, the matching with me, which hospitals are in which districts and how they use them. I can get that.
I was just saying,
is
half of the type A hospitals in these districts, or...
I don't know off the top of my head. Yeah.
Madam Chair, I'd also point out that they have taxing authority. The amount of revenue they can raise is pretty marginal.
Is it?
Just because of the size of the district and also room under the... I mean, it's marginal. It's a subsistence sort of thing. So it's not a get-rich issue at all.
Well, it would reflect here if it was...
That's right. That's working. Type B hospitals, again, it's the same thing. The smaller hospitals are have lower operating margins overall.
Now, the type B are the ones that are within 30 miles.
Right. They can be within 30 miles of another acute inpatient facility, but they are small hospitals, less than 50 beds.
They do better than the type A.
Mm-hmm.
But again, these are median numbers, and there are hospitals that fall on either side of this.
Mm-hmm. The next slide shows the payer mix statewide by DRG hospitals and by type A and type B hospitals. And again, I think just to note that Medicare and commercial are really the bulk of the payers here. Rural hospitals do rely on Medicare a little bit more than the urban hospitals do. And again, the Medicare does pay many of those, if not most, of those rural hospitals at 100% of costs.
Roughly.
Uncompensated care is the last piece of this. Uncompensated care is a combination of charity care and bad debt, as the discussion before we got up here made clear. Charity care is services valued at full charges provided for patients who have been determined by the hospital as unable to pay. Bad debt are unpaid obligations for care provided to patients determined to be able to pay. It's sort of hard to evaluate charity care in that every hospitals have different standards for eligibility. They have different approaches to making the information available to patients. They have different areas that their hospital actually resides in, so there may be different levels of need. So it's hard to evaluate what a level of charity care means. Charity care is, though, as again was stated earlier, is calculated against full charges.
So if you have a person who's unemployed in his 20s, has a $4,000 or $5,000 charge from a hospital. What's the process? How do they treat that person then?
It differs at different hospitals, but I think generally, what differs is how aware the patient might be that there's a charity care policy or a financial assistance program in place. But they can.
And not all hospitals have a.
I have not. Every hospital I know of has some charity care policy. There may be one, but I haven't run into them. I mean, it shows up on their financials. So. The process is that whether they have to ask whether there's some financial assistance available for them, or it's posted right there when you sign all your admitting papers, which is what it is in some hospitals. You ask, and if you meet their criteria, it's not necessarily a problem, but the issue is that criteria might not be the same for across hospitals. One hospital will be different with the one across town might have a different standard.
Thank you.
So it's financial eligibility generally. Always. The next slide, the last slide, and again, Appendix 2 of this report shows the breakdown for 2003 by hospital so that you're not stuck just with these median values. The again, we used median because the average gets pulled, the average, the large hospitals influence the average so much. So median actually tells you half the hospitals are above this number and half of them are below it. So this is the experience over time with uncompensated care when you calculate it as a percent of gross patient revenue.
Although I would add that the term uncompensated care, we all and everybody pays for this care in one way or another.
And that's all I have on the report. I'm happy to take any questions you might have.
I think you did very well.
Oh. You didn't need a doctor. Thank you very much, Dr. Boltberg and Ms. Edlund. We will continue on with Behind Oregon's Healthcare Crisis, Elizabeth Stevenson from Services Employees International Union.
Thank you. I'm going to power up my computer here for just a second. I just asked Dr. Goldberg to stay around to restart my heart.
Okay, thank you very much. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Liz Stevenson, for the record. I'm a senior analyst with the Service Employees International Union, working with our national team of researchers on the critical healthcare finance issues affecting our 1.8 million members and their families. Prior to this position, I worked as the research manager at the Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research with Dr. Goldberg, and before him, Dr. Santa. I received my master's in public health and epidemiology and biostatistics from Oregon Health and Science University. And before that, I received my Juris Doctor from Northwestern School of Law at Lewis and Clark College. Thank you for inviting me to testify today. I've worked with Oregonians for Health Security, which is a broad coalition of healthcare advocates, to present the paper you have in front of you. And I have to apologize. I have a slideshow here, but I didn't bring the handouts because, as you know, anytime you have a day that's really important, your copy machine will break down and your printer won't work. And that's exactly what happened today. So I can get you copies of these handouts, and I'll put it up on our website or something for you later. First, let me tell you who SEIU, my employer, is. We are one of the nation's largest participants in healthcare purchasing, negotiating healthcare benefits for the families of our 1.8 million members nationwide, including more than 100,000 members and their families here in Oregon. We are also the nation's largest organization of healthcare workers, with about half our members working in hospitals, nursing homes, long-term care, and other healthcare settings. SEIU, therefore, brings dual experience to healthcare issues based on our members' extremely diverse experience as both healthcare workers and healthcare consumers. Let me tell you what's worrying us. A recent survey of Oregon businesses found that more than 9 in 10 decision makers at businesses around Oregon rated the cost of health care as some level of threat to their organization. And 1 in 10 Oregon business decision makers say that their organization has considered eliminating employee health care benefits altogether. Dr. Goldberg told us last week that in the private sector marketplace, he's seen studies that although employers haven't yet stopped providing health benefits to its workers in great numbers, they have shifted more of the cost of health care onto its workers, and workers are now responding to this by sometimes limiting their coverage or declining their coverage, especially around dependent coverage for their families. And that's why I'm interested in this issue and what I'm here to talk to you about today. From a health policy point of view, we know that when the price of health care increases, access decreases. That's a simple equation that is absolutely true.
Madam Chair, I disagree to a degree that where the services are delivered can change. If the cost of health care increases and they lose benefits, they go to ERs. So access to a lot of services are going to still happen, but there can be a shift in where the services are delivered, not just people don't just suddenly say, I'm not going to get the service. They go to a different place to get it. So that's a factor, too.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, I agree with you. But also, there are studies that show that people put off going to see doctors, and they won't go to the emergency department if they know that they have to pay for it themselves a lot of times. So that's what we're really worried about. The largest part of a personal health care expenditure, you've already heard this, is, depending on how you measure it, somewhere between 30, we say 36 cents of every dollar of healthcare dollar that you spend. When we look at the, I hate to use acronyms because I understand you don't like them, but CMS, we all know what CMS, Centers for Medicaid Services. When we look at their numbers for total healthcare expenditures, we look at from the private sector, we look at the personal healthcare spending dollar, and 36 cents of the personal healthcare expenditures are on hospitals. It's the largest segment of our dollar is spent on hospitals. In the past few years, one of the drivers of healthcare costs in Oregon is the rise in prices and volume in the hospitals. In Oregon, we think that we are a low spending state for hospital care. And historically, that has been true. However, we think that those days have come to an end. And the information I've been developing, because I can't wait for CMS to come up with the state spending figures, show that spending in Oregon hospitals has been at a greater rate than spending across the nation.
And where did you get that data?
Let me go through this one by one here. This first slide is CMS data on that it's fairly old. It's from 1981 to 1998. What it shows is the percentage increase year by year of hospital expenditures. And I put up there three things. I put up the national average. I put up Oregon. Oregon is the darkest line. And I also put up the state of Maryland, just for comparison. And out of those three numbers, over that 18-year period, Oregon's annual rate of growth in expenditures was greater than either the national average or the state of Maryland's at 7.9%. CMS has not updated these numbers, and I've been waiting for them to do that. They didn't do it. So I went ahead and tried to pencil out what I think has been happening since 1998. This is the actual dollar amount of health care expenditures in hospitals in Oregon since 1998. Started in 1998 around, let's say, $3.2 billion. to the last year I have data, which is 2003, and it's up to nearly $5 billion is what's being spent by patients in hospitals. That's all payers. It's the commercial side and the governmental side.
And do you have comparisons to the another state?
I don't have another state, but what I have is the national average. So I put underneath the bar line the percent increase year to year. So the 6.7% in 1999. Underneath that, in parentheses, is what CMS reported out as the national average increase for hospital expenditures across the nation, which was 3.9%.
So in 2002, we were below the national average, but then in 2003, we were above.
That's correct. Okay. And the average in this time period, from 99 to 2003, Oregon's percentage increase was 8.4%. The national average was 6.4%. That is alarming to us.
I'm sorry.
Yes, Senator Cruz?
Have you factored in length of stay, level of acuity?
Nothing.
Because
no.
Clearly there has to be a factor. I mean, if the costs are up because the services are at a more intense level, that kind of fudges the figures. So.
And you're absolutely right, Senator Cruz, Madam Chair. This is not adjusted for anything. This is just exactly how CMS would report these numbers out as a total expenditure on hospitals.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think if there's anything else about this slide I want to tell you before I go forward. And exactly that question was in my mind. What accounts for this? Is it volume increase? Is it population increase? What is it? And from our point of view, we want to be able to separate that out. This is why I wish CMS would do this for us a little better, because, you know, I'm just one person. They have a stable of people. So what I tried to do in a rough way is look at a per capita, so adjust for our population growth. We've had a 20% population increase in the last 10 years, roughly, something like that, which is about 1.5% a year. So I tried to adjust for that using a per capita. And this is really a very rough slide. But what I tried to do is say, okay, our per capita hospital expenditure in Oregon is, and the 1995 and 2000 numbers are actual. It was, you know, less than $1,000, or a little less than $1,000 in 95, up to about $1,000 in 2000 per capita. And then I projected it. If we continue on in the rate of growth at the numbers that CMS thinks we're going to continue on with, and we continue on in the rate of growth that we have experienced in the last 5, 6, 7 years, we are going to catch up to the national per capita expenditure in hospital care somewhere between 2020 and 2025. And that is alarming to us.
I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Chris.
Did you attempt to factor in, you know, the growth of the population in the state? A huge portion of the folks moving in it's a senior population, and the population is aging in general. But I would say that we're getting more seniors than little kids in certain parts of the state. So, I mean, did you attempt to factor in that? The growth is happening, but the level of utilization of services with that senior population is going to escalate also.
I didn't. And Senator Cruz, let me be clear. All I was trying to do with this number is try to get a handle on potential population growth. Now, I think if I got a good demographer to help me with that, we'd find that these numbers are going to escalate even further. This is a very conservative estimate right here. So, and your point is a very good one, that when you look at the demographics of who is moving into the state, that is a very good point. Thank you very much. So this is very important to us to get a grasp on this. This is why we did this report. Spending is going up very rapidly in Oregon, and in the private sector, what I'm not going to show you because I haven't done a very good job of this yet, but what I'm trying to get a handle on as I go forward here is how much is that government expenditure going up and how much is the private sector going up. I haven't done that yet. I hope to do that in future reports. Now, in our report, what we have found, what we're very serious about, is that we are concerned about the change in the hospital industry in the last 10 years in the state. National experts have talked about what consolidation in the hospital market has meant to the prices for hospital services. And in our report, we found that consolidation in the hospital market, we believe, is driving the price vis-a-vis payers of hospital services. In other words, as in a market, when a certain hospital system or the one hospital in the town consolidates its market, it can demand a price and get payment for that price. In much of the state, there is only a single hospital provider. In the Portland area, it's consolidated to the point where there really is not very much choice. There's two hospital systems in the Portland area that pretty much control the market. When we looked, we tried to test this theory, and what we did was we took whatever data we had available to look at the prices in hospitals from a system hospital perspective and from an independent hospital perspective, one that's not part of a system. It's very difficult to do with the data that we have available for us. But what we found when we looked at the hospital discharge data is that when you look at the most prevalent cases in hospitals across the state, if you're looking at vaginal deliveries, system hospitals, master charge price was 11% higher. When you look at back and neck procedures, 26% higher. When you look at cesarean sections, 32% higher, and down the line. We looked at it in the Portland area, and a similar pattern emerged. Now, this is not a perfect analysis of price in hospitals, as you heard from Ms. Bauman, who very clearly set out that the sticker price in a hospital is oftentimes not the price being paid. But this is the best we can do with the data that we have.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator.
Thank you. I guess I'm especially tri-county systems. I'm wondering the independence. It would be interesting if you factored in the demographic of the population being served, because if it's a high Medicaid, Medicare population, are naturally going to be lower, where some of the other hospitals in more affluent communities, the numbers are going to be higher. So I think that's a factor you might want to consider including.
Mm-hmm. What we did was we used what's known as the refined DRG, the RDRG. And what that does is take into account some of those things, but it's not a perfect measure by any means. So thank you. And I have another handout for you. I'm going to get a little bit personal here today. I actually have my hospital bill from one of them that without the name, with actually my name on there. You can see it. Mm-hmm. And about, not quite a year ago, I had a simple little outpatient procedure at Providence Portland Medical Center. And I have to give you a little story here with this bill, which is I needed to have this procedure done as an outpatient. My physician, I asked him, he actually asked me, he said, where would you like to have this procedure done? Your choices are Legacy Emmanuel or Providence Portland. And I said, well, gosh, which is cheaper? And he said, I've never been asked that question before. I have no idea. So I went to his front office staff, asked them that question. They had no idea. I called Legacy Emmanuel and asked them, and they couldn't tell me. And then I called Providence Portland, and I said, well, can you tell me what this is going to cost me from your hospital? And I said, no, we can't tell you that. And I'm an insured person, of course. I had Regents. And so, whatever the date on that bill is, a month after my procedure, I get the bill in the mail. And it shows that the master charge was $7,000, something like that. I think I don't have it in front of me. I gave it all away. But $7,000 or something for the master charge for a six-hour procedure. I penciled in there that Regents had negotiated, I think it's a 64% discount there. Thanks. And 63.9% discount. Regents then paid 85%. I paid 15%. I just want to show that as an example of what kind of discounts are out there for the private market. The other bill I have for you is actually my mother's bill. She wanted me to black out her name and address, but she gave me permission to show this to you. She is an elderly person on Medicare, and last summer in a hospital in Eugene, she had a hip replacement. And Medicare got a 50% discount off of that three-day hospital stay. So I just think it was interesting. I mean, I hate to parade me and my family in front of you, but I think it's interesting the different kind of discounts that are being given for different kinds of services. I might also add, if you want to talk about my entire family, my brother was uninsured and had to go to the hospital in Eugene recently, and my parents paid the bill, and they were going to pay full sticker price, and I stepped in and said, no, you have to get a discount, and I talked to the administrator, and they said, great, 5% if you pay today upon discharge. I was outraged, I have to tell you, but we didn't do any better than that. That was how much we paid. So, from a consumer point of view, this is not working. When we're looking at system hospitals, and our concerns around this are large, we looked at the Medicare cost reports for system hospitals, and all the hospitals. We got the Medicare cost reports for the last several years on all the hospitals, which is a humongous database, and it's really, I'm still learning about it myself. And we got some expertise in that, and we looked at what the total operating expenses in these hospitals are, and we started pulling apart what accounts for the operating expenses. And one of the things we looked at was administrative efficiency, because we were very interested in, we asked the questions, are system hospitals good because they're more efficient? They do a better job. And what we found out is, no. I was kind of shocked when I did this analysis. I had time before I published this report of doing one year of the Tri-County hospitals, and I found that the system hospitals, nearly 18% of their operating expenses were due to administrative overhead, whereas 14% of them in the independent hospitals were due to administrative overhead.
Now, and the systems hospital?
The systems hospital in Portland would include Legacy, Providence, Portland Adventist.
And an independent is?
Willamette Falls, Quality Hospital.
Couldn't some of that be chalked up to economies of scale? I mean, if you're a bigger system, you got more to manage.
We kind of thought about that, and we used the same lines for all the hospitals, and I consulted with people across the way about what lines in the Medicare cost report to use, and they said, these are the lines. This is your administrative lines. And so whatever it costs to administer those hospitals, that's what's in those lines. And this is one year. This is only 2003, and since I published the report, I've gone back, five or six years to see, does this get better? I mean, is it up and down? It is the same over time, at least for the last 5 years.
Madam Chair, I guess, I had a work group on ESD reconfiguration last night, and looking at school districts, education service districts, you find, the smaller ones seem to be able to be more efficient in some ways, and maybe their book of business isn't as great, but you get to larger scales and there's more administration necessary to cover all the bases. So, just to come up with numbers is nice, but you need to kind of ferret out the reasons why those numbers might be different rather than just putting up numbers.
Senator Cruz, fair comment. I want to emphasize that I didn't put their home office costs in here. This is just the hospital administration costs. So I'm not going to argue with you about it, but I tried to think through those issues. In the Portland area, system hospitals make more money than the independent hospitals. This is just from the audited financial statements that Dr. Goldberg's office collect. I went to national sources because I want to put this in perspective of where they are nationally. I went to the Solution Sourcebook, which is a trade organization that the hospitals rely on to understand how they're doing in connection to other hospitals nationally and with other states. And what I found is the median operating margins of the hospitals in Oregon over time are better than the national averages. And as Tina Edlin told you, the median ratio, operating margin ratio, is a ratio that shows you the profitability off of patient revenue only. So then I looked at the total operating margins of hospitals over time from same source, from Solution, and found that they're doing really well compared to national hospitals. In fact, Oregon's hospitals are some of the most profitable hospitals in the nation. So with this in mind, we believe that system hospitals are driving prices in part because they're inefficient and in part because they're so powerful in the markets where they dominate that they're able to exact these high prices. But as Dr. Goldberg's report shows, utilization has a stake here as well. So I think Tina Edlin had told you that when they adjusted for a population increase, the utilization in hospitals has gone up over the last 10 years from 100 per 1,000 population to about 100, I think it was 106. We don't know what the utilization in outpatient services is. There isn't any good data for that. And that's one thing that we would really like to have, because we understand it, from national literature and from looking at indicators from the audited financial statements, we believe that outpatient utilization is increasing and also driving prices, and we need to get a handle on that. So in future reports, SEIU and Oregonians for Health Security have asked me to...
Madam Chair, can we go back one slide?
Sure.
Because, you know, we just got a report on this, and your graph doesn't even look like anything in the report from Uber. And I'm looking at, okay, maybe you're just recording DRG hospitals, but your graph doesn't match that either.
Oh, that's a very good point. These are non-critical access hospitals that they compare with non-critical access hospitals across the country. So these are your DRG hospitals, but also some of your type A's and type B's, the ones that are not critical access. And they're not going to match Uber's report because it's a different cut at the data. This is the only way I had of doing a national comparison that was apples and apples.
Thank you.
And I have a couple of slides just about Oregon's hospital ownership, how much it's changed in the last 10 years. System hospitals have increased 53%. Independent hospitals decreased 34%. In the Tri-County area, it's been consolidated for some time. Two system hospitals closed in 2004. Those were the Symphony Hospitals, Eastmoreland and Woodland Park. They closed early 2004. And in the last 10 years, one independent hospital, the one in Forest Grove, merged with Tuolity. And this is the acute patient days market share of the Tri-County hospitals. System hospitals in the Tri-County area take up more than 90% of the private sector or the market share in acute patient days. Independent hospitals are down to 8%. So in the next reports that I plan to put out, OHS, Oregonians for Health Security, and SEIU have asked me to look at several things. One is charity care. And we touched on a little bit today, charity care, and I just want to reiterate that there aren't really good defined lines in Oregon about what is charity care. And I want to do a detailed report, you know, detailing out what charity care is in the state and what significant impact they've had on the hospitals, if any, and what it means when 17% of Oregonians are uninsured and what that means for charity care. I want to do the next report, on construction of new hospital facilities. We're seeing a lot of construction. And how much of our health care dollar is going into construction?
Madam Chair.
Yeah. Yes, Senator Morrison.
And having something to do with Lane County, of course, you're going to be looking at the Springfield-Eugene area and the construction of two brand new hospitals for multi-millions of dollars and
yeah,
what that's going to do to health hospital costs. Thank you. Hurry up and do that.
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, yes, absolutely. I mean, to me, it's like the poster boy for bad health planning.
Yes.
So,
well, Madam Chair, one should point out that there were issues with the city of Eugene on the ability to get zoning changes to expand for the services needed to be delivered. So let's not look at this in an isolated universe. If Sacred Heart didn't have the ability to do what they needed to do, and the city of Eugene wouldn't let them do it. So they were kind of between a rock and a hard spot. So I understand your issue, but as in all of these things, there are other factors.
Yeah, the other factor is that they're taking McKinsey Willamette away from Springfield and putting that downtown in Eugene, in a bad place.
I started, Senator Morissette, Madam Chair, if I might, I started to put together a matrix recently of how much construction is going on and the dollar amount and the bed increase, and that will be in this next report. My list is incomplete. I'm up to $1.3 billion in 1 year, and it's the cranes are going up everywhere, and it's something we need to be concerned about.
On the other hand.
So also we want to talk about quality in hospitals. This is a really unknown area for us. We have one national report out about quality in the hospitals that we've looked at from a group called HealthGrades in Colorado, who's doing national comparisons using Medicare data. This is really worrying us quite a bit. I mean, in the beginning of my testimony, I told you we represent healthcare workers in the hospitals, and I'm here to tell you that they're great workers, and they believe in what they do. And so when we see these reports come out about poor quality in the hospitals, that hurts us to the bone. Our workers are not poor quality workers. But it's something we have to think about, and we have to talk about openly in order to make sure that the dollar amount that we're paying for health care brings us not only access to health care, but access to quality health care. So we plan to address that in a future report. We would really appreciate the opportunity to come back and talk to you all when our new reports are coming out. So I'm open to any questions, and I'll do my best. Thanks for letting me testify today.
Senator Morissette.
One of the interesting things that happened in our area is that there was a restraint of trade, I believe it was, decision made against PeaceHealth because of a sweetheart deal that they had with Blue Shield Blue Cross, I believe, over certain procedures. And that was a huge settlement that they finally won. And that, I think, is the advantage of these big hospitals. Even though they're on profit, they're huge, and they can really throw their weight around.
That's right.
And a little, poor little non-profit hospital like McKinsey Willamette, which was founded 50 years ago by community volunteers, consequently is no longer there. It's another big makeup chain that came in to buy it. But, I mean, there is a difference with the big hospitals in being able to get the kinds of contracts with insurance companies that can be tough on little hospitals.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. Senator Morissette, couldn't agree with you more. I have a personal story about McKinsey Willamette Hospital because I'm from that area, and my grandfather was a Weyerhaeuser employee in Springfield. And he lived in Eugene, and in the wintertime, the reason why McKinsey Willamette was built was because the river flooded. There were no dams on the river down there. And the river would flood, and folks in Eugene, or who were in parts of Lane County, had no access to the hospital in Lane County, in Eugene, at the old Sacred Heart Hospital, which is Peace Health now. And so you'd have to take the train to get across that flooded river to get to your job in Springfield. And finally they said, you know, this is too dangerous. We need to have a hospital in Springfield. So for Springfield to give up their community hospital has been a wrenching decision.
Very wrenching.
Awful.
Yeah.
Have you shared this report with Dr. Bruce Goldberg?
I have, yeah.
Okay, so that he can look at your data and see how it corresponds with the research that they have been doing. Yeah,
yeah.
That's good. Well, yes, Senator Cruz.
I'm thinking, Chair, maybe a couple questions. Medicaid reimbursement rates are a driver of a lot of things because they're so low. You know, do you have any idea how much covering the lack of payment for Medicaid is adding to your members' insurance policy, insurance costs, or what the loss of standard is doing, or what sort of, or I mean, I don't know that you necessarily have these numbers now, but just as a comparator to some of the drivers here, because clearly Medicaid is a driver, and certainly we could bump up Medicaid reimbursements, but the question then becomes, where do we find the general fund dollars to do that? Which would be a problem. So, you know, and if we're going to do that, where would you get the money? Which is another thing. I guess, Madam Chair, it was an interesting report. My father told me a long time ago there were three types of lies. There was lies, darn lies, and statistics. And so I guess I would like to have, when we get your report, if we could have your data sources and the assumptions that went into it, just so we can kind of put this in perspective. I think that would be very helpful. Especially when you got there towards the end and I was looking at Uper's report and trying to compare it to yours, and I understand you're going off of a different data source and trying to compare nationally, which is really hard to do, but I think we need to be careful on assuming facts and evidence without all of the backup behind them.
Having talked with the hospitals, I think they're very aware of this issue, and especially after the public testimonies, and many of them do see this as a concern and want to, I think, start looking at ways to become more transparent and to share the reasons why these costs are going up. Anyway, this is an issue. This is what Oregonians want. They want us to address the health care cost crisis that we're in, because we are going to implode or explode, however you want to look at it, if things keep going in the direction that it is, and none of us want to see that. Thank you.
I think Senator Cruz has a point, and I think all of us look at data depending upon where we're coming from as well, and we put that into our own data bank and we process it and so on. So philosophically and other ways. So I thought it was a great report.
Thank you. Comment at this point? I am trained as a statistician, and there is another. I don't like your quote about damn lies. I'm sorry. But let me leave you with another quote that's a little better. Okay. Statistics is human stories with tears washed away.
Okay. Madam Chair, as an econ major at Willamette, I had to take a class in statistics, and I was totally befuddled the whole time I was through, and God knows how I passed it. But the one thing I came away with was the fact that you can make numbers do whatever you want. So I'm not discounting what you said, but it's how you ask the questions, how you approach the data. I mean, that's the one thing I carried away from that class, and because I couldn't do a standard deviation to save my life right now, Madam Chair.
Well, you're not a statistician, so. Okay. Thank you. Is it Liz or Elizabeth?
Liz is fine. Thank you.
Okay. Any other discussion? All right. On Friday, we're going to be having our Health Policy Committee in Gresham, Oregon, mm-hmm. in my district, actually at the Allied Health Center of Mount Hood Community College, and they have a wonderful new training program, and we will be discussing the healthcare workforce shortage
And I would like to know, Senator Cruz and Senator Morissette, will you be there?
Absolutely. Yep.
Senator Courtney, will you be there?
Looking forward to it, Madam Chair.
We will be hearing Senate Bill 450 and Senate Bill 460. We will be having work sessions for sure on those two bills for the public that needs to know that. And it is invited testimony. There will be... The public will be invited to testify on issues of the health care workforce issue only. We'll only have about 30 minutes of public testimony on that. Any other discussion on that? We will meet at noon. We will have lunch together. And
where
then I don't know.
Okay.
If it's not good, we'll come to my house and have something good. And then we are going to have a tour of the center, the simulation labs, and then committee meeting. And hopefully we'll get out by 4:30. 3:30. 3:30. 3:30. Meeting adjourned.